Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense. We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies. Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, infographics, relevant links, book suggestions, or just to leave comments. Follow us on Twitter at @SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks. Today is December 8th, and this podcast is a repost of my recent appearance on the Free Your Mind podcast. There's a link to that in the show notes. I recommend this conversation for those of you who are newer to our work and or interested in the history of public schooling. In this conversation, I make an effort to tie the past to the present, and Bill, the host of Free Your Mind, provides some prompts. And I use those prompts to basically give a quick history of the developments, the key developments of public school in the United States. And some of you are saying, Brett, we've heard all that. So I tried to, in this discussion, add some new storylines, including the story of Elward Patterson Cubberley, big fan of social engineering. So we're going to talk about a book that he wrote in the 1930s. Called Public Education in the United States. Now, when I talk about Cubberley and his justifications for why the schools took the direction they did in the first few decades of the 20th century and why they needed to continue to move down that progressive directed path, it might even sound in this conversation like I'm defending him. I am not. Cubberley was through and through an academic. He worked at Stanford and Columbia, worked where he was shielded from many of the realities of the real work world. So he'll make declarations like, hey, we don't need the apprenticeship system anymore. Kids don't need to learn how to do useful stuff. Those are nice things to say from ivory towers in academia. But all Cubberley could really see through most of his career was the factory system. The goal, essentially, of a lot of these progressives was to channel as many Americans as possible, especially considering there had been significant booms in immigration, another thing that's going to come up on the show today, at the beginning of Cubberley's career, and then again towards the end of Cubberley's career. First one at the end of the 1800s, second one coming in the 1910s and 20s. So what do we do with all of these characters who are showing up, Cubberley asks? Get them into the factories. And, you know, we talked in the past on the show about Alexander Inglis and his six functions of secondary school. The progressives did also recognize that the public schools needed to have a sorting mechanism. But what seems to be the unifying thread, one of the unifying threads, there are many through progressive schooling thought throughout the first three or four decades in the 20th century, was this idea that kids need to be there longer. Look at us, said the academics. We're the adults, and we still hang out at school, shielded from the realities of the economic and social world. So why not you? A little more complicated than that. We're gonna talk about it in the show. I don't want to be reductive here. And we see this right up to today, that there are people in government and private industry and academia having some pretty significant decision-making powers in the future of young people. Federal programs like Common Core, which are essentially designed to prepare Americans for the service economy. So our message is not for everyone. Most people alive today will never escape this script that is being written for them. They will never be able to author their own lives, and that's very sad. As a result of that, in the 21st century, we see society going in at least two divergent paths. We live in this information age where many people are able to find opportunities and turn them into lucrative ventures. These things didn't exist 20 years ago. But more and more people, unfortunately, really in the last 15 years, are being schooled into the acceptance of service sector jobs. But federal government intervention in the quote-unquote education of young people has other consequences as well. Most of what we talk about in our conversation today in terms of the history of public schooling in the United States actually happens after the importation of the system from Prussia and the progressive meddling with the system in the first few decades of the 20th century. We're going to focus today on the 1960s and the 1970s, when private foundations, corporations, think tanks, government agencies, and universities teamed up again to design education for the future. And today we are the inheritors of that design. And I wanted to start here with an article that was published in 2001 at insightmag.com. It is written by B.K. Eichmann. She also wrote a book in 2007 called Walking Targets: How Our Psychologized Classrooms Are Producing a Nation of Sitting Ducks. And let me just read to you a quick summary of this book, if that title intrigues you. This is from eagleforum.org. Public school curriculum, while failing to provide most students with a solid foundation of academic knowledge in literacy, math, history, or science, devotes more time each year to students' feelings, motivations, beliefs, and worldviews. Now, that sounds nice. I know that sounds nice, but we're going to flesh that out a little bit better in this article that I'm going to read, The Dark Side of Nationwide School Tests. In Walking Targets, B.K. Eichmann sounds the alarm on psychology-based programs in schools and on the more general psychology-based mindset that treats every individual quirk as a classifiable mental illness demanding medication. The book collects the author's essays and articles covering topics such as universal mental health screening, invasive school surveys, outsourced parenting, and the looming threat of government surveillance and data gathering. Each essay incisively identifies what the government and schools are doing that they shouldn't be, and what they are not doing that they should. While the middle class spends thousands of dollars each year to protect family and property from crime, taxpayer money goes to programs that, in the name of safety and well-being, invade the home and family in search of mental illness and pathology. These programs condition students and others to government interference in spheres of life well outside the government's competence, which is everything, I would think. Incidents of school violence and other tragedies serve to justify new psychological focus and measures such as mental health screening. You will hear about that in the show today. Quote, only a few seem to connect the sudden urge of high-profile student violence with the progressive undermining of adult leadership, denigration of religiously based moral values, lurid media entertainment, and lack of substantive tasks to occupy the child's mind and time, writes Eichmann. Eichmann also points out that the failure to teach basic civics has created a generation of voters to whom half-baked socialist ideas sound plausible and convincing. The rising large egalitarian faction believes that, quote, the socialist system falls short only when legislation fails to give everyone an equal piece of the pie, unquote. Walking Targets paints a frightening picture of society where children are less and less equipped to resist tyranny, at the same time that data gathering, profiling, and surveilling make tyranny a more and more present reality. Well, damn. So here's this article, and then we will get to my interview with Bill from Free Your Mind podcast. The Dark Side of Nationwide School Tests by B.K. Eichmann, published August 8th, 2001. President Bush's education initiative calls for the testing of every student in the nation, but these assessments in the past involved Big Brother-style psychological profiling. The proponents of George Bush's education initiative, called No Child Left Behind, believe they can make schools accountable to parents as well as taxpayers. The centerpiece of this, as it appears in the amendments to the Elementary and Secondary School Act, still in House Senate conference as this article goes to press, is a massive nationwide program designed to test every student in grades 3 through 8 in reading and math. Both House and Senate bills propose some $400 million in federal funds to be sent to the states to devise and administer the tests on a state-by-state basis. By giving tax money to each state to devise its own tests, supporters hope to mollify conservatives on the one hand, who fear national indoctrination by the U.S. Department of Education, and liberals on the other, who dread the consequences of holding educators personally accountable for whether the children they teach actually learn. The language of House Bill H.R. 1, for example, states in an unresolved contradiction that each state shall demonstrate that it has adopted, quote, challenging academic standards and challenging academic achievement standards. In the same breath, the bill says that, quote, a state shall not be required to submit such standards to the secretary. Now think about that, right? Obviously, that's a contradiction, but if that contradiction exists, why do this, right? The problem is that academic standards, as defined by common sense and by lawmakers, tend to be meaningless when defined by educators. The bill calls for, quote, challenging academic content standards in academic subjects that specify what children are expected to know and be able to do, unquote, and contain, quote, coherent and rigorous content and encourage the teaching of advanced skills, unquote. Yet both House and Senate bills shy away from using the term tests and substitute the edu-speak word assessments. The reason is that public education during the last 30 years has tended against testing for knowledge of content, instead emphasizing a psychological assessment of the child's needs, background, and ability to conform to a group. A test is an objective measure of a child's ability to solve a problem. An assessment is a social scientist's speculation about the environmental conditioning of the child. Thus, the assessment of a child's ability to read or to do math in the current testing already in use has more to do with probing the child's psyche and teaching him or her to conform to group values than with testing ability to add 2 plus 2. The leading educational experts will read the bill's language as a license to invade the privacy of every child in the country rather than hold failing schools accountable. And since the bill necessarily honors the principle of local control, it is likely the local educational bureaucracies doing the controlling will welcome the bill as a $400 million slush fund to do exactly what they have been doing to thwart educational reform. The trouble with school tests begins with the increasing inclusion of sophisticated behavioral components that encompass a wide variety of lifestyle and opinion data, nailing down student proclivities, social attitudes, and parent-inculcated worldviews. Combined with the plethora of health, which is sex and drug surveys, mental health screening, diary, journal keeping, and other miscellaneous questionnaires, mostly taking place in the classroom under the cover of academics, testing has become more equated with personality inventories than proficiency exams. In that context, what passes for testing may even undermine the accountability President Bush advocates. The case against standardized tests hinges on the quantum leap in data gathering, cross-matching, and information sharing capabilities, with all the accompanying problems associated with data trafficking, invasion of privacy, and consumer profiling. Barely a week goes by that a publication somewhere doesn't carry a story detailing a new affront to what used to be considered nobody's business. One of the earliest examples of psychological data gathering under the cover of academics occurred in the pivotal 1980s, when enormous breakthroughs in computer technology were being piloted with federal funds in selected localities. One of those was in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, initiated under the 8-State Cooperative Accountability Project. A handful of parents, among them Jen Sutton, Anita Hoag, and Francine D'Alonso, got wind of a standardized academic test that no one could possibly study for, being disseminated in the McGuffey School District, the Educational Quality Assessment, which will be referred to from this point on as EQA. After several unsuccessful attempts to gain access, a trip to the State Education Agency in Harrisburg finally yielded the facts. Not only did more than half the questions not relate to factual knowledge, but numerical codes next to the questions as printed on the administrative version of the test turned out to correlate with specific remediating curricula. Those of you who have been listening for a while are hearing echoes of Peg Luxick in her YouTube video, Who Controls Our Children? We talked about that in greater detail in episode 152 of School Sucks podcast. It was called Behaviorism in Disguise, Outcome-Based Education. That's from July 23rd, 2012. I'll put a link to that show in the show notes. So this test included questions such as, I get upset easily at home. A, very true of me. B, mostly true of me. C, mostly untrue of me. D, very untrue of me. Another question. You are asked to dinner at the home of a classmate having a religion much different from yours. In this situation, I would feel A, very comfortable. B, comfortable. C, slightly uncomfortable. Or D, very uncomfortable. Another question. This one is interesting. There's a secret club at school called the Midnight Artists. They go out late at night and paint funny sayings and pictures on buildings. I would join the club when I knew A, my best friend had asked me to join. B, most of the popular students in the school were in the club. C, my parents would ground me if they found out I joined. The last question in particular got parents' attention. It presumes that the child will join the club under some circumstances, including the desire to provoke parents. They thought the question more or less asked, how can we get this kid to vandalize property? The EQA had 375 questions covering attitudes, worldviews, and opinions, mostly hypothetical situations and self-reports. There were 30 questions on math and another 30 covering verbal analogies, just enough academic questions to appear credible. Every such test is distributed with professional literature for the educators, which is strictly off-limits to the parents. The EQA told educators it was testing for the student's, quote, locus of control, his willingness to receive stimuli, his amenability to change, and whether he would conform to group goals. In lay terms, these translate to, where's the child coming from? Is he easily influenced? Are his views firm or flexible? Is he a team player who will accede to group consensus? Choice B, then, was the preferred response to the Midnight Artists question, because it reflects a willingness to conform to group goals. Today, such testing is more sophisticated. A fascinating aspect of a recent Michigan assessment, for example, 5 science questions for 5th graders concerned universal child fingerprinting, but involved no science. The multiple choices, even the incorrect ones, seem more like endorsements than questions. Fingerprinting doesn't hurt. Lost children can be identified, etc. Not a single downside was offered. The one question that sounded like a question was so simple that one could reasonably have asked whether this were the reading or the science section. Quote, fingerprinting is most useful in which of the following jobs? A, police work, to help in crime fighting. B, window washing, to help clean windows. C, auto mechanics, to help cars run better. D, teaching, to help kids learn to multiply. Now, there's a few more examples, but I want to skip ahead a bit. And I'll make sure this article is in the show notes if you want to read the whole thing. A few paragraphs later. Some profiling instruments are explicit and blatant, such as Pennsylvania's and Michigan's, while others are more subtle. Most states label them assessments rather than tests, further confusing the issue for parents. Regardless of the label, opponents claim that personality testing in the context of an academic setting and the psychotherapeutic sales packages, curricula, that typically ensue, portend a high-tech threat not only to privacy but to a child's future employability and freedom of conscience. Then there are the student identification methods applied to confidential tests and surveys that testers say are not individually identifiable. That doesn't mean, however, that the students are not individually identified. Confused? The National Center for Educational Statistics 1993 Field Restricted Use Data Procedures Manual explains this semantic sleight of hand. Techniques range from simple barcoding and slugging to more complicated exercises such as sticky labeling and inserting embedded identifiers. To the testers, however, the term confidential means need to know. The confidential label casually applied by officials to modern testing and survey devices invariably is taken for anonymity, thereby masking the fact that 1. Higher scores are accorded preferred viewpoints. 2. Curriculum is modified and targeted to specific groups of children to correct inappropriate attitudes. And, more ominously, 3. Certain views that were considered principled are now deemed rigid and associated with mental illness or psychological defects. Among the at-risk indicators are viewpoints and behaviors deemed by the testers to be what they call indicative of a rigid or underdeveloped belief system. Pupils are referred to psychologists for remediation to render their attitudes and responses more realistic. The article continues on for several paragraphs, but many of you are probably wondering, how did this come to be? After all, many of us, perhaps even some of our children or nieces and nephews, have been subjected to these tests. Their genesis was in the late 1960s and early 1970s. They were the logical next step in the progressive design on American public schooling. Because this is an interview, I do spend a bit of time discussing my background with Bill. If you feel you've already heard enough about that, feel free to skip to the 30-minute mark. Here we go.
Oh, man, it's great to have you. And I've been a big fan of yours. I found out from you from the Peace Revolution, Richard Grove over at Tragedy and Hope.
Yep.
And you guys are good friends, aren't you?
Absolutely. I found out about most of the world from from Richard Grove. I'm pretty sure he did the first podcast I ever listened to. It was the predecessor to Peace Revolution, and it was called 9/11 Synchronicity. And I think I first encountered that, I want to say, 2006, 2007, somewhere around there. And that really opened my eyes to a lot of new things. He and I became friends in 2010. I went down and was interviewed in his living room for a documentary done by a filmmaker in Vancouver named Paul Verge, who interviewed me on Skype while Rich filmed me in Connecticut. So that was my introduction. I was impressed with his operation. It's only gotten more impressive since then. And yeah, he's definitely a good friend.
Well, and your operation has gotten impressive since you started as well, and you got a couple accolades recently. Can you tell us about those?
Accolades? I did? Oh, my goodness. Maybe I need to be more grateful. I've already forgotten them. What were they?
Well, didn't you get number one in education?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in the Podomatic. Podomatic is the site where we host the podcast, and sometimes I look at iTunes numbers and will appear in the What's Hot in the education section of iTunes. But that's rare because so many shows fall into the category of education that, you know, anytime somebody wants to teach a foreign language or do like, a personal, what's it called, life coaching kind of podcast, they all wind up in the education category. So back in the day, we were number one in education every day, at least for a good while, and then the category got very crowded. So now when we appear in the number one spot it's done every day based on downloads, and it's actually kind of frustrating. The site Podomatic, they tried to basically convert the podcast hosting site into this like social networking thing. So they have this secret formula for how you appear in the rankings, which is frustrating because at the time they changed their measurements, we were number one in education every day, and we were always in the top 20 podcasts out of tens of thousands of podcasts that are on the site. And we still do pretty good on there. We now kind of are juggled between the top spot and, you know, the fifth spot or anywhere between. It depends on, you know, whether I put a show out or what else other people are doing. Rich is in that category, so he often grabs the number one spot as well.
Well, and it's just so unique that we live in a time and age now that we can create our own television, radio station. You know, back when we were growing up, this would have cost us millions and millions of dollars to build this platform. And now each one of us are building our own and spreading our the message of truth in our own unique way. And what I like about your message is that you actually sat behind the scenes. You were in the belly of the beast, so to speak.
Yeah.
As a teacher. And I would like to talk about that. What was that like? And how did you wake up to the fallacy of the indoctrination process that we call schooling in America?
It was slow, and it there were a couple different wake-ups, and they kind of eventually went into a kind of confluence where the all of this noise of revelation just got too loud for me to continue with what I was doing. A big part of it came working in what was technically private school. And this was in the very early days of my career. I was about 20, one when I started in a private boarding school in Vermont, all the kids in the boarding school came from being in state custody. And I, at one point, was in charge of, you know, giving out medication. And I started to realize, wow, these kids are really heavily medicated for very, very little observable changes in their behavior, but conversely, very, very, very noticeable changes in their level of energy, in their weight, in their overall health. And, you know, I was the one giving them the pills. So that was like out of the abstract for me, you know, for sure. I mean, I had studied history a little bit at that point. I still think I would have identified as liberal, but I think I had a healthy skepticism for power. And what I saw and what I was participating in was a little bit disturbing. So I think that was like a wake-up call. After the initial wake-up call of just going to college and getting a more, you know, revisionist version of history, that, you know, all this stuff that you learned in elementary school, middle school, high school was indoctrination to try and build, you know, a positive patriotic vision of the country. And it's not that there isn't some merit to, you know, the achievements of Western civilization, but to just blindly wave a flag and, you know, say things like love it or leave it. I mean, that's the history that most people get in their lives happens in government school. So it was an initial wake-up call to get, even though it was like a left-wing kind of agenda-driven version, through people that I still respect, like Howard Zinn and Noam Chomsky, that was what I think took me out of a complete slumber. And then I think I had a more keen eye for noticing some of the problems in the other private schools that I worked in between 2000 and 2006. And then I moved on to private tutoring in the greater Boston area, working in, you know, the good, air quotes, the good schools filled with wealthy overachievers who had their eyes on Ivy League colleges. And I became involved with the public system at that point, even though I was technically still just on the periphery of it, in a more intimate way. I was in the schools. I was meeting with teachers and parents and guidance counselors. You know, I think at the time I had some very young nieces and nephews. This might have been like 2006, 2007, around there. Okay. And I saw them as being filled with energy and optimism and curiosity. And I was working with a lot of these kids who came from, you know, lives of privilege, achieving in school. They were involved, and it seemed like they had a lot of things going for them at 16, 17 years old. But they just seemed so drained, like worn down, unenthusiastic, not curious, not, even though they were getting good grades in school, they weren't really evidencing great critical thinking skills, which the SAT, that's what I was tutoring most of them in, calls on in people. Like, you have to have critical thinking skills to do well on certain aspects of that test. And a lot of them really struggled with that. So I, around this time, was, you know, becoming more liberty-minded, you know, 2006, 2007, discovered Rich's work, as I mentioned earlier, started listening to shows like Free Talk Live and then Complete Liberty and ultimately Free Domain Radio. And at the same time, looking into the problem of public schooling, I had crossed paths with the work of John Taylor Gatto a few times in the past. But I think I was in a library one day and I just encountered this article that he wrote for Harper's Magazine online. I don't even remember what I Googled, but, or whatever the search engine was then. It was Google. So it's like, this was like 8 years ago. I found this Against School article, and he talked about, for the very first time, the origins of the public school system in the United States. And I just took what he said and looked at my surroundings, looked what I was involved in. And I think that was like one of those moments where there was no going back. So the confluence was encountering Gatto's education criticisms, encountering the philosophy of liberty, and the lessons that I had learned trying to be a good worker in the system, you know, or in this larger complex. Even though I never worked as a teacher in a public school, I was very much involved in a government schooling and child care complex, and I just couldn't be enthusiastic about participating in that. So that was what got me to, you know, 2009, August of that year, I started fiddling around with podcasting. It was a $10 startup cost. I went to Radio Shack and bought a little over-the-ear mic, and I started recording my thoughts about school into Audacity, and that was the beginning of the podcast.
Fantastic, man. And here we are today, and that was
6 years ago.
Yeah, man. Look at how time flies. And it's just crazy how we're in December now, and it's like, where did 2015 go? You know, seems like it's going quicker as we get older here.
Oh, yeah. This year zipped by.
Oh, totally. You know, and it just seems like next year. And next year, by the way, we are going to, there is a Free Your Mind conference in Philadelphia, and I'm going to be there as well. And if you're in the area, man, I would love to meet you in person. That's going to be April 15th, 16th, and 17th. Check it out, freeyourmindconference.com.
I would be interested in that. I was born in Redding, by the way.
In Redding, California, or Redding, Washington?
Pennsylvania.
Or Pennsylvania.
Where you were talking about. Yeah. Like 45 minutes outside of Philly. Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay, cool. Well, yep. I'm a West Coast guy. I'm up here in Seattle. So
I got you.
Associated over here. So, you know, I wanted to, you know, and God bless, you know, I love who you were talking about earlier, John Taylor Gatto. I just looked right up here at a stack of his books, and what an amazing man. And I didn't realize what an amazing man he was until the history lesson that Richard Grove did with him, the ultimate history lesson. It's available on Blu-ray at Tragedy and Hope. Definitely check it out. And, you know, let's go back to the origins of the schooling in America. And before we do that, one quick question. When you were in college and getting your degree to become a teacher, did they ever tell you that you're going to be giving pills to kids?
Well, it actually was happening after that. I went to like undergraduate school in, my major was communications. And I had this professor in college that his enthusiasm and his knowledge of the subject matter, he was like, he had this steel trap mind for the Civil War, you know? And maybe there was like a time or two where, you know, we asked him where some general went to the bathroom at Appomattox, and he would say, I don't know, but I'll find out and I'll let you know on Wednesday. You know, like he just knew everything. And I was really impressed by that. And I was also like really moved by this discovery that the subject was interesting. So even though I had gone to college with this goal of being in the mass communications industry, either in television or in radio, based on ambitions that I'd had when I was much younger, I graduated with much more of an orientation toward teaching, toward communicating that way. You know, I think it came from this need to like speak and be heard. But I realized, hey, I could get that need met at the front of a classroom. Or maybe I didn't consciously realize that at the time. So it wasn't until I had graduated from college and I had taken this job at this boarding school because of some experiences that I had, this history professor, his you know, progressive political mindset, and also I had done an internship for a film company where one of the producers that I was working for was very socially conscious and politically active, and he had done, you know, he'd been on like the committee for the Massachusetts public schools, and I would sit in his office and, you know, help him with certain tasks like going through his filing cabinets, and he had all these news clippings of all these political things he had participated in. So those two experiences I had around the age of 20, 21 made me start thinking much more about I can have an impact on the world by being a team player, you know, helping people via the government or quasi-governmental organizations, which is how I actually, when I was a senior, wound up working at that boarding school to give something back. You know, this was my idealism at the time, you know, that I owed it or that I wanted, just maybe even just wanting to feel efficacious and having that kind of positive change. So I was extremely naive by the time, like I moved up there pretty quickly. And within, you know, 6 months, I had some additional job responsibilities. I had started at the bottom, at like an entry level position at the school, and because I was a college student. And, you know, I got med certified and I just did what the authorities told me to do. They knew what to do. What did I know? I was only 21. You know, if you give drugs to kids, that's what the clinical director dictates. So by the time I went to graduate school and had this difficult experience actually, you know, on the ground in, you know, government serving children type setting, I thought that the treatment of education in graduate school was extremely naive. You know, so it was almost like your question was, about my naivete, right? And I was plenty naive at the time, but by the time I got to graduate school, where I would have learned about, you know, interventions, chemical interventions that were becoming increasingly popular at that time in public schools, I already had some experience and I was already a little bit jaded. And I think a lot of the other people that I was in class with at the time who were teaching in public schools in New York and Massachusetts, they were also very jaded because of things like No Child Left Behind. So what should have been, you know, a lot of young, enthusiastic people getting the training they need to get out there in the world and change the lives of young kids, they were just kind of these bitch sessions most of the time, the classes. People just complaining about, you know, having to adhere to state standards and inspectors coming into their classrooms with clipboards, you know, things like that. So the answer to your question is no. At no point was I told that there was going to be there was no real talk about that anywhere that I was. I did a secondary ed certification program for public school history teaching, and then I did a master's program in educational leadership.
Well, and I think that this just speaks to, you know, that indoctrination process and how what it does to our brains and what it does to us as individuals, and takes away that individuality. There we go.
Yeah.
You know, and makes you conform to the group, making you think that the collective is much more important than the group. But, you know, that's not necessarily the case, because all the atrocities that have been committed throughout history have been committed with this type of group think. And in 1850s, when they did the schooling in America, what did they do to conform or to make this model conform to a more group-centric type of model?
Well, you know, it's interesting to think about. I mean, there were two phases that I've talked about on my show before of basically building the schools, or the starting process of building the schools into what they are today, 150 years later. So the first one comes in the middle of the 1800s with the importation of Central European schooling systems to Massachusetts via Horace Mann and a handful of others, who initially started by submitting what was called traveler's reports. They would go and they would see the schools, mostly in the Kingdom of Prussia, and they would write these glowing reviews of, oh, you know, this is what we need. This is regimentation and order and structure and the establishment of a national identity, which was very useful to those in power. And I think Horace Mann, who in many ways was also very naive, probably sincerely believed that that structure could be imported to the United States without having some of the destructive impact that it had had on the Prussian society. Mann was gung-ho for that system from the beginning. And when we think about the traveler's reports as a fact-finding mission, I, from what I've read about Horace Mann and his desire to go, quote-unquote, investigate, it was basically just confirmation bias. When Mann got to the Kingdom of Prussia, the schools weren't even in session. He never even saw them in operation. So Horace Mann, the father of public education, as he's called, that's what he was called when I was in graduate school, imported a system that he never even really saw into action. And, you know, one of the motives for bringing that system here actually was to deal with an issue that's causing a lot of stress and strife in America today, and that's immigration. You know, so there, and this was actually, you know, part of the impetus of the progressives who came 50, 60 years later and actually continued probably into the 1930s or 40s in the true progressive educationist form. People like John Dewey, Alexander Inglis, Elward Cubberley, they wanted homogenization. They wanted people to fit a mold. And once they got that mold, and we move on into the 1950s and 1960s and 1970s, they build on that mold. They perfect it. They want it to be testable. So I think we can get into all of that. But is there any more detail I can go into about the importation and development of the school? Because it involves a lot of different types of people who, even though they have some you know, political commonalities. There's also a lot of ideological diversity in the people who set up the schools between, say, 1850 and 1930.
Right. Well, I mean, look at the ongoings of the world during that time, and the Industrial Revolution, I think, should be mentioned, and their need to fill these factories with workers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, could you speak on that for a second, Brett?
Well, yeah. I mean, you also have in the South the end of slavery.
Right.
So that's a pretty significant, reliable labor force that is no more. So, yeah, you start to see, I mean, a lot of man's motivations, in addition to, you know, a kind of cultural homogeneity, were also religious. He was a very religious man. But by the time the progressives come along at the turn of the century, the beginning of the 1900s, we actually find through, you know, the painstaking studies of somebody like John Taylor Gatto, and there's a few others who've joined him in that quest, that a lot of these progressives were being funded by American industrialists, like the Rockefellers, through places like Columbia University. So they had a stake, too. They didn't want a world of poets and philosophers, to paraphrase one of the excerpts from the Rockefeller Education Board in 1906. They wanted to say, hey, there are people who were born to do menial tasks, and we want them to do those tasks better than their parents or their grandparents did them. And that's what the school will produce in our dreams. You know, people yield themselves with perfect docility to our molding hands. You know, that was what they said. So I think we can balance that with the reporting of somebody like Thaddeus Russell and his book, The Renegade History of the United States, where he credits, you know, a lot of renegade behavior going all the way back to colonial America as being partly responsible for the freedoms, even though in many cases they're dwindling, that we in the 21st century still enjoy today. In other words, they had to push the envelope, right, out of Puritanism and into a kind of liberalism. Liberal mm-hmm. meaning free, not meaning, you know, political left.
Right.
I think that if you were trying to maintain some control over a productive society with some hope of a prosperous future, the motives of these people, considering the populace they were looking at, you know, Thaddeus has these stories about, you know, they're trying to build a railroad and you've got immigrant Irishmen getting drunk and throwing bottles at each other, right? Intolerable workplace behavior, any place where I would be the boss, you know, and that was a pretty dramatic problem that they had to try to solve. Now, when you read the bland ivory tower self-congratulatory tomes of these progressives who came along in the 1910s and the 1920s, it's really hard to have any sympathy for that agenda, right? But it wasn't an evil plan through and through. Right. They were responding to a real fear based on some pretty troubling observations about, you know, American society in the 1860s, the 1870s, you know, whether we're talking about the North or even in the South, which was just thrown into chaos by the Reconstruction process after the Civil War. So I think I did a disservice for too long, even, you know, in some of the content on my show, of you know, reducing this whole narrative to one of good and evil. It's very complex. I think people did have real and valid concerns about some of the immigrants who were coming here. I'm not a big fan of, you know, this call for assimilation, you know, the same thing people are calling for today. I don't see why assimilation matters so much if you remove, you know, government handouts from the equation. I'm willing to be educated on that subject, and I'm actually looking to speak to some people who do have more hardline attitudes, anti-immigration attitudes, because I want to be challenged. I want to understand that better. But the attitudes that we're hearing today, even from people like, you know, Stefan Molyneux, are echoes of the concerns that existed over 100 years ago.
Absolutely.
And I'm not saying that
all of those concerns are completely without validity. It's just, I don't want to fall into a trap of talking about, you know, immigration controls and borders. And I don't think anything like that has a place within the philosophy of liberty. But the present definitely mirrors the past in that respect.
Well, and it's always cyclical. We got to figure this stuff out. You know, we got to, and with technology that is available to us, we have at our fingertips access to so much information. And that's the other component that has been taken out of this education, quote unquote, air quotes, education system. I'll call it schooling system, is the critical thinking aspect. And if we had that back in our world today, just the 42 logical fallacies, if people knew and just didn't take declarative sentences in as fact, if they knew to question information and to go through it in a logical way, I think that we could fix a lot of these problems or not even go down some of these paths that seem to be dead ends. Can you speak on that? And what is the difference between education and schooling?
Well, I think, you know, who wants schooling, right? I think that's the question. Who benefits from schooling? The most powerful players in the corporate economy, which we've already touched on, even though the face of that has changed dramatically since the Industrial Revolution. The powerful players in the system of finance.
Well, and just for a second, imagine put yourself by proxy into one of these big, powerful positions, okay? And pretend like you have a ton of underlings underneath you, and you tell them to do something, and they turn around and say, why?
mm-hmm. You know,
and it's not really really conducive, effective, efficient business when people are stopping the whole way and wanting to know exactly why they're doing this.
Well, related to that, you know, I would also add to that list of players is anyone who supports the idea of a strong centralized state. You know, so they are the ones with the motives for government schooling versus authentic learner-driven education. You know, a lot of them talked and wrote publicly, or as public as these things got. I mean, most people who wrote about these things 80, 90, 100 years ago didn't really foresee mass consumption of their books and essays through things like, you know, archive.org. But in the late 1800s, even though the country did have, you know, a variety of social problems to which immigration contributed, there was a kind of rugged individualism and a what I think Gatto called a Yankee entrepreneurialism. Hmm. And a lot of the people who were trying to shuffle Americans into these factories summed that kind of attitude and lifestyle up of the individual or the entrepreneur. They called it the menace of overproduction. Production needed to be controlled, and people's productive capabilities needed to be essentially channeled into the serving the needs of managerial classes, you know, be they corporate or government. And, you know, I even think that are you familiar with Elward Cubberley?
I am not. I think I might have heard his name, but I'm not familiar with any of his work.
So it's easy for us, again, to look back at these types of people. Elward Cubberley wrote a piece in 1934 called Public Education in the United States.
How do you spell his name?
Cubberley. And just the quick abstract, let me pull up his Wikipedia. I have it linkable here. An American educator and pioneer in the field of educational administration, he spent most of his career as a professor and later dean at the Stanford School of Education in California. He joined the faculty at Stanford and then went to Columbia University, where they all seem to go, where he earned a PhD in 1905. He returned to the Stanford faculty in 1906 as a professor of education and then was the dean until he retired in 1933. During his career, he maintained a view of education as an instrument of social engineering, a view that created some controversy. So that's Cubberley. And in this piece he wrote, Public Education in the United States, I have an interesting excerpt. And what I was saying is we tend to, knowing the results they got us in the United States, they are considered to be bad guys. And I think that this kind of view of humanity is ultimately very toxic and costly, right?
But black and white type of stuff.
Exactly. But he's talking about the transition of society that was very, very palpable, you know, at the end of the 1800s and into the first few decades of the 1900s. So can I read an excerpt to
Absolutely.
You here? It's a few paragraphs, but I think it's interesting. The school has been called to take upon itself the task of training in those industrial experiences and social activities which once formed so important a part of the education of American youth. So he's talking about basically the dissolution of the private farm. With the breakdown of old home and village industries, the passing of old chores, and the coming of the factory system in city life conditions, it has become desirable that children should not engage in productive labor. On the contrary, all recent thinking and legislation has been opposed to their doing so. Both the interests of organized labor and the interests of the nation have set against child labor. Even from an economic point of view, all studies which have been made as to money value of an education have shown the importance of children remaining in school as long as they are able to use with advantage the educational opportunities provided. It has come to a generally accepted principle that it is better for children and for society that they should remain in school until they are at least 16 years of age. As a result, child life everywhere has recently experienced a new lengthening of the period of dependence and training, and all national interests now indicate that that period devoted to preparing for life's work should, for most children, be further lengthened than shortened. Everywhere, the right of the state to compel communities to maintain not only the old common school, but special types of schools and advanced training has been asserted and sustained by the courts. Conversely, the corollary to this assertion of authority, the right of the state to compel children to partake of the educational advantages provided, has also been asserted and sustained by the courts. And then just really quick, there's another section here called New Social and National Problems. As our social life has become broader and more complex, a longer period of guidance has become necessary to prepare for proper participation in it. As our industrial life has become more diversified, its parts narrower, and its processes more concealed, new and more extended training has been necessary. Large-scale production, extreme division of labor, and the all-conquering march of the machine have practically driven out the apprenticeship system, which was very important and something that Gatto was a huge proponent of, through which, in a simpler age, young helpers were taught not simply the technique of some simple process, but the arts and mysteries of the craft as well. The journeyman and the artisan have given way to an army of machine workers, performing over and over one small process at one machine, turning out one small part of the finished article, and knowing nothing about the business beyond their limited and narrow task. Now, you could say that he's talking about that in a way like, hooray, this is going on. Or if he's just reporting what actually is. And if you are a progressive and a collectivist, the fact of the idea of fitting people to perform very narrow, specific tasks that best serve the collective makes perfect sense. This actually, if you totally accept the idea of socially engineering society by experts and collectivism, that might sound pretty benign, especially at the time, especially pre-Russian Revolution or pre-Nazi Germany. So historical perspective is important here. Today, right. Yeah, this is a bad guy. This is a really crappy outlook, for sure. But back then, I think that his observations might help the desire that a lot of liberty-minded people would have to view him as a thoroughly evil character.
Well, and you know, there's a saying that goes, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, and that's just
yes.
You know, exactly what we're dealing with. And that's where, you know, when I question people about, you know, following orders and doing things that they should not be doing, a lot of times that's exactly what they say is that, you know, my intentions were good. I just was naive. And we also have to look at the time of the century where we had Ford just started his assembly line. And this was the start of the compartmentalization and to build out these factories bigger and bigger. And, you know, just like that mighty machine that you were speaking of, You know, that's what they needed. They needed people that were not linchpins, that were cogs. They needed cogs to come and fill these roles in these factories. And so what perfect model would you have a kid or a child go into than something that mimics perfectly that factory model? So for instance, instead of being out on the farm, we need a bell, ding, 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 that's going to send to the school. And then a bell is going to signal right around 10 o'clock, our first break. And then we have a bell that signals our lunch. And then we have a bell that signals our another break. And then the end of the day. And then as we go through that 15,000 hour indoctrination process, it makes total sense that as we leave this institution to go into another institution, that it mimics the model almost perfectly.
Indeed. But yeah. Then you have, as the U.S. begins to interface more and more, sometimes quite aggressively, with some of these, I guess you could say, comparatively nefarious powers, you know, like in Stalinist Russia and Nazi Germany or Imperial Japan, these attitudes can't be so public anymore, right? This like, hey, we're America, we're special. This is about the individual. This is about freedom.
Individual, that's right.
So what happened was that a lot of that cubberly type talk, you know, that is completely in line with what you're saying. It sounds like a perfectly rational view of how to scientifically manage a population for the greatest good or the greater good, right? That kind of rhetoric was basically driven underground in the 1940s and the 1950s, you know, when it was all about patriotism and what makes America special. The progressives really had to take a back seat to that message, you know, when the war cry started. And even certainly in the Cold War, you know, you couldn't, there was a period, I would say, late 40s, throughout the 50s, and maybe into some of the 1960s, where these people couldn't go around blurting that message.
Well, loose lips sink ships. Didn't you know that, Brett?
Indeed. Indeed they do. And they really, they were running a tight ship after that period. And in the 1960s, I think, we really start to see the modern education system, even though it's the school system, excuse me, it has many remnants from what happened with the progressives and even with the importation of the Prussian system. It still holds many of those properties. The development of the modern education system, recognizable to us probably through our school experiences, starts to take shape in the 1960s and 1970s with a series of underground follow-ups to that progressive vision. And most of it is related to things like teacher training, measurement, and assessment. And it's all funded by, again, you know, corporations, think tanks, government agencies. It's guided by universities and private foundations. And most of it is coordinated through what was called at the time the U.S. Office of Education, which was essentially the predecessor to the Federal Department of Education. A few that I read about that were interesting and kind of disturbing. One was called Designing Education for the Future. Mm. Another one was called the Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project. And the other one was called Bloom's Taxonomy of Educational Objectives. So just a little bit about each one. Designing Education for the Future was really about using the schools as a tool of governments to achieve the not only economic goals, which you can almost understand, like if you're going to have this system, it should work towards national economic goals, but also social goals of a national character. That's their word. Hmm. And they should essentially, the public schools in a given region should be willing to surrender their independence. Because, I mean, you look at the size of the United States, even from region to region, and I know we're kind of, we're starting to see this momentum building towards a new type of culture war. And maybe in like the minds of American conservatives, it's already been going on the whole time. But I think a lot of it is like libertarians are being dragged into this culture war now. The United States contains many different cultures, even just among, you know, Caucasian natives. The way people live in northern New Jersey versus the way people live in southern Georgia you wouldn't think that that was even the same country or culture, you know? Okay. So this effort to basically, again, homogenize the people of the United States through the schooling system is one of the characteristics of things like designing education for the future. And the state departments of education basically became enforcers for a federal government agenda to basically give up a regional individuality, even though no such thing exists. It's just the best term I can put to it, to produce a nationwide predictable product.
That's right. You want to be able to predict exactly what these resources are going to be doing for you. And also, you know, I think it bears to mention the propaganda campaign of World War II and how they took and saw the results from that, and they polished it and tailored it to this homogenization that you talk about as well.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, today we know, and we can even go back to World War I and, you know, Edward Bernays.
Oh, yes. Edward Bernays. That's
so
right.
Who influenced American government and American corporations. He was hired to do so. But that influence kind of rubbed off on Goebbels and the Nazis. They were impressed by a lot of what was going on, as far as most people in America were concerned, underground, you know? So mm-hmm. so that public perception management was very important, which is part of the reason why this education as scientific management and social engineering project couldn't be as public as it was in the 1910s and the 1920s. So we're on the right track with that as far as what it's supposed to do. The other projects that I mentioned, the Behavioral Science Teacher Education Project, was a lot about measurement, as was Bloom's taxonomy. So, you know, the Behavioral Science Education Project, and these all happened at universities in the late 60s, early 70s, included things like tracking people by numbers. They even used the phrase chemical experimentation. They talk about a future where few people, because of the increased access to information, few will be able to maintain control over their opinions. So we will have to manage those opinions. The school's very much through that project, you know, considering that it is behaviorist in nature, the schools are very much laboratories. When Gatto talked about it, he said something like, "This is to promote the idea for students that your peers are insane."
Wow.
"And this is why you need control." Gatto has this kind of disciplinarian streak that I'm not really in love with, but his thinking about a lot of the transformations of the in the schools in the late 60s, early 70s was kind of like letting the kids run free suddenly.
Yeah.
Right now, he would promote the idea of kids being set free right from the very beginning. But if you put a kid through institutionalized schooling where you have to ask permission to speak and go to the bathroom for like 6 or 7 years, and then you just say, "Okay, go wild," you're not going to get good results.
That's
so he almost saw, he said something like the schools became a mass demonstration of human inadequacy.
Oh, wow.
You know, and that what was going on there was basically good advertisement for the necessity of authority, you know? So, the final one, Bloom's taxonomy, was just basically a tool, in their own words, a tool to classify the ways that individuals are to act, think, or feel as the result of some unit of instruction. And it also talked about, you know, what happens when we, through assessments and testing, encounter improper thoughts.
Hmm.
And how will we remediate them? From there, we get things like outcome-based education, which I talked about on the show, school-to-work programs, No Child Left Behind, and Common Core, which all have this heavy reliance on standardized testing. But standardized testing really, really isn't about measuring how the student has learned the content delivered in the school.
Or how they can critically think and put things together.
It's absolutely just not. It's about adjusting attitudes or examining the school's effectiveness in adjusting attitudes, which is extremely dangerous.
Well, and that's where, you know, where I come in. And those of you that don't know about me, freeyourmindpodcast.com is where you find me. But I'm a dog trainer. And in a million years, I would have never thought that I would be doing a podcast talking to Brett and Richard. But as I go along, I mean, it's this information needs to be known. But I wanted to share, you know, my unique insight with this as well as somebody that works with animal behavior. And I saw a big disconnect with results. Like the standards that were present, people were not adhering to them. And we were looking at these different philosophies of training, and they're mostly derived from Skinner and Pavlov. And what I want people to realize, too, is that these philosophies that people almost adhere to like religion. It's silly how people will stick to this. And even though the behavior is not what we want, they don't see it. They go back to the philosophy, and it speaks to that indoctrination. And also, when I would question people about this, I would receive that love it or leave it attitude mm-hmm. that we spoke about earlier, you know? And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? I thought we wanted to help dogs. I thought we were doing this to make a difference in the world and not just spin our tires and pretend that we're helping when obviously we're not. And that got me studying Pavlov and Skinner. And even before the 60s and 70s, in 1948, B.F. Skinner published his novel, and it's called Walden 2.
Yes.
And it's okay. It's not really a good read. It's from his own perspective. But, you know, it was about a utopian society ruled by logical, scientific methods of behavioral control. And Skinner furthered the idea of a coercion-free, air quotes, society his entire career. And, you know, in order for this to work, this is where that collectivism comes in. Everybody needs to be on the same page. Basically, it's like an HOA with unlimited authority to declare whoever is deviant, you know?
Yeah.
And then people, the global elite or whoever were kind of working this behind the scenes here, they were throwing money at projects that endorsed their type of thinking or brought about this, I don't know, proper way of living. And, you know, people need to realize that all this stuff was done in an acoustic chamber, in a vacuum, without the wealth of external stimuli that we find in this world around us. And it's a fallacy to even hold on to this stuff as real truth, because it's a recreated science experiment. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, would you say that as it's true, or is it true with both humans and animals, that the goal is essentially a kind of docility, so that the heavy hand never needs to show itself?
That's right. The velvet glove.
Yeah.
You know?
That's really interesting, because now those attitudes or that psychology, which basically has run the government schooling system since probably the 1940s, and really, as I just mentioned, took off in the 1960s and 70s, is bumping up against the availability of information. And a lot of people are having, you know, the same attitude or that same wake up, that same angry wake up that I had as a 19, 20, 21 year old college student, where it's like, hey, wait a minute, you know, I was lied to my whole life. But we still have all that training in, well, I'm not potent enough to interfere.
It's too big for us to do anything.
Well,
you know?
Yeah. So it's like, here comes this information, and all of the angst that it produces is met with this, you know, more subtle or even often unconscious feeling of being completely unable to self-direct. To take action, you know? And I'm thinking about what's showing up on America's college campuses today. I actually just did my last show about this with Thaddeus Russell. It seems like there's a lot of people who are saying, we're angry. We're not going to take this anymore. You need to manage us better.
Wow.
You know? So you have this...
I need my safe space, and I need you to not microaggression against me, and I need this space right here. You know, and it's just like, watch these people.
Yeah. Excuse me.
Is that what you're talking about, Brett?
I think so. It's kind of like, help me. I'm feeling like, I'm trying to think of the best way to say it, like my docility is in danger. I don't know. I mean, what I see is just this, you know, it's either this misdirected or poorly communicated kind of passion, right? And waking up in this world of like a sleepy disengagement and meaningless consumption. And because of this docility, like people have lived, you know, these people are in college, so they've lived most of their lives before that, much like I did, certainly in middle school and through much of high school, with the attitude that there's like no apparent purpose for being alive, you know? And suddenly social justice. Well, wait, I found it. I found my purpose. But they can't be effective in that purpose that they want to embrace because of that, or at least that's a contributing factor because of that behaviorist training that they've encountered, you know, or that's been forced on them throughout their entire schooling history until now.
Well, and just look at the statement that we made earlier today, Brett, and same thing with Richard, how we, you, me, and Richard, all three of us, have learned more in the past 5 years than we've learned in our whole lives.
Yeah.
And Richard, when I spoke with him, he says that, you know what, let this show you the capacity of the human being and that our ability to learn is always present and that these systems of control don't have the effect as much as they should as long as we're made aware of it. But it is a pretty big shoe to drop when you realize that not only have you been living a lie, but you've been participating in it.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that was my wake-up call. I thought until maybe I was like, 22 or 23, that I was doing all the right things to be helpful to society, which was basically just following directions in an extremely corrupt system that was hurting children.
Well, and it's, you know, we're taught not to rock that boat.
Oh, yeah.
Just go through life and not cause waves. And we are coming towards the end of our hour here, Brett, but I think that maybe we should do this again and talk about, go more into modern day schooling and what we can do as far as parents and people that have kids. I don't have kids. I had the custody of my sister's kids for a while, and man, what a learning experience. And the biggest thing that I learned when I had my sister's kids was it never ends. You know, you can't take a break from this. It's always going on. And what a big responsibility it is to raise a child in today's world. And would you be interested in maybe coming on and talking about homeschooling and some solutions at a later episode, Brett?
Yeah, absolutely. Because I think we're seeing, a lot of parents today really kind of lured into taking the same shortcuts that the progressives and the behaviorists tried to take. You know, how do we get docile compliance?
Yeah.
And that seems so prevalent in you know, my observations. I'm involved in a good community here, so I see a lot of peaceful parenting taking place. But I also interact with people outside of that community, and I see some things that are really troubling, even in my own family. So, I'm not a parent myself. But I certainly did spend quite a bit of time as a child, and I've worked with hundreds of children ranging from the age of 6 to 17 and 364 days, you know, according to the law. So I have a lot to say about that subject, and certainly on the subject of home education as well. So I would love to do that, Bill. Man, I can't believe that was an hour. That shot right by.
We really did. Well, and we're coming to the end here, but I just wanted to, you know, just make sure that I got you because we need to continue on this conversation. And just like what you were speaking earlier about, or just now about being a child, it doesn't matter how old you are with some of these people, the way that they act is childish.
Yeah.
Because they do not have that resource to draw back on to know how to critically think and how to disseminate or to process information. And so it almost is like it creates a schism in their mind, and they get into that reactive modality. And there's a great quote on your website, Between Stimulus and Response by...
Yes, I believe it's at the bottom of every single page. Am I about to prove myself wrong? No. You ready? Here it is.
Okay.
Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. In our response, or in that space, lies our growth and our freedom. Viktor E. Frankl.
So it's our job to widen that space, to get out of reactionary and start reasoning.
Yeah.
And that requires, you know, some time and some space for yourself, too, to get out from under all of these social stigmas that cause fear, and to realize that there is a point to life, and it's realizing your own power as an individual, and to critically think, and to start to talk to people so that they may understand their own power as well.
Yeah.
And it's just walking the walk.
You know? Absolutely. And that's been, you know, for the last few years on School Sucks podcast, drawing awareness to that space. I remember I first heard that quote on Rich's show, Peace Revolution Podcast. It first appears in my show around episode 90-something. It was about Osama bin Laden. And I have tried to, through our content, draw attention to that space and talk about strategies for widening it. So when it comes to things like critical thinking, we did a series on the Trivium Method. We did a series called Logic Saves Lives. When it comes to our relationships with ourselves, we did a series on Nathaniel Brandon's Six Pillars of Self-Esteem. And I encourage people to not accept some BS definition of self-esteem. Look at Brandon's conception of it as a series of practices that we can do every day. When it comes to communication with others, we tried to widen that space through an exploration of things like nonviolent communication. When it comes to how we interface with our work world, we dealt with it in productivity in a series called Presence and Productivity. And most recently, again, with relationship to the self, we looked at adverse childhood experiences and trauma, and tried to draw awareness to how those experiences, how childhood trauma shapes the adult self and what to do about it. So we try to continuously focus on the opportunity that exists in that space, and we experiment with what can go inside it to produce a, you know, happier and more prosperous and ultimately a freer life.
Listening. If you enjoyed the show, please help us out by leaving a positive review on iTunes. If you were angered by the show, please help us out by leaving negative reviews everywhere. If you think this is an important message for students, for parents, or for the future of intellectual freedom, please consider supporting us. SchoolSucksProject.com/AV. For $6 a month, you'll get access to hundreds of additional hours of content while helping us grow and spread this message further.